So my name is Maitreya Bandhu, and I'm going to talk for a few minutes, or about 20 minutes, something like that, hopefully. I can easily, once I get going, sometimes it's difficult to stop me, so I will try to rein myself in at the right moment. So I'll talk for about 20 minutes, and then there'll be a bit of space for questions that I might or might not be able to answer. Okay. So welcome everyone to the London Buddhist Centre. Really nice to see so many people here on a lovely Saturday. So yeah, well, really nice to see you here. So what I'm going to do really is just say something about the Buddhist vision of happiness. See how we go, yeah? And then at the end of that you can ask me any questions and I can solve all your problems. And then we'll all be happy. And for no charge. So there's lots of ways of kind of approaching this subject, but I want to approach it using one of the very traditional Buddhist kind of systems of practice, a kind of structure of how you try to practice to work with your mind. Hey there, come in. Try not to step on things. There are cushions on the other side of the room, if you can get across to the other side of the room, which is a kind of little challenge in its own. There might even be a chair at that one. Yeah, so I want to just explore one kind of teaching from the Buddhist tradition. It's a very ancient teaching, 2,500-year-old tradition. I want to see how it applies to us here and now in the West and into our quest for happiness. So you want to just sit down in the corner is probably best. I know that space is a bit of a premium. Great, people settle down. Okay, so if I look honestly at my experience, and I would even venture to say if you look honestly at your experience, you find that you want to be happy. I find that I want to be happy. But almost everything I do, almost everything I think, almost everything I plan to do, is with that aim in mind. It's to be happy, isn't it? Human beings, right at the very centre of ourselves, want to be happy. It's our deepest wish, really. We don't quite know what it means. we struggle to define it sometimes. But we definitely know that we want it. We definitely know that we don't want to be unhappy, and that we want to be happy. I would say even though it's a bit further than that, we want to be happy all the time. One of the difficulties of contemporary life, I think, is that the media is selling us the image more and more that we can be happy all the time. That we should be racing around laughing and making mobile phone calls and planning our diary whilst cooking a gorgeous meal for four or something, you know. These constant pictures of sort of satisfaction and happiness. But irrespective of that, we do want to be happy. Irrespective of that, I want to be happy. I don't want to be unhappy. I even feel I need to be happy. So I think that's where we need to start from, not with some kind of idea, not with some kind of belief, not with some kind of ideology, but the simple fact that we want to be happy. And we want to be happy more and more. If possible, we want to be happy all the time. And that, from what Buddhism would say, is just natural to us. We naturally want that. We come into life already wanting that. And we feel very disappointed, even frustrated, even embittered, if we don't experience that. It's almost as if we believe that life kind of owes us happiness. But the great tragedy of the human situation, I think, is that we want happiness, we crave happiness, but we don't know where happiness is to be found. We don't really know where you can reliably get happiness from. So we try one thing, and then that doesn't quite work, and then we try another, so we go from snowboarding to bungee jumping to I don't know, deconstructive philosophy to feminism to whatever it is. We go from one thing to another, hoping it's going to make us happy. Even perhaps we might go to Buddhism in the hope that it will make us happy. And often that sort of search for happiness is in itself a cause of unhappiness. We try this therapist and that, this psychological system, then that, this self-help book and that. And that, even if you're not careful, becomes a source of unhappiness. But nevertheless, we can't help but search for happiness. But we don't know where happiness is to be found. I think this is the tragedy of the human situation. That the thing that we most want, we don't know where to find it. We kind of half know. We're not absolutely bonkers about it. We don't sort of intentionally do horrible, nasty things that make us unhappy. We kind of half know what will happen, make us happy. We don't really know. So you could think of Buddhism as a quest for happiness. But that quest, meeting that quest at a higher and higher level. But it needs to start sort of right off, right now, with our actual experience here and now. So what I want to do is apply these four spheres of mindfulness, which I've written about in my book. very dicey photograph of me on the back. I want to apply these four spheres of mindfulness to this question of wanting to be happy. So, first sphere of mindfulness is noticing our body. Yeah? Noticing our body. Coming back into the direct sensations of our body. Many of us in the West live a bit like we're kind of like a head on a stick. You know, we hardly even notice we've got a body sometimes. We just are caught up in cognition. We're stuck on the kind of windscreen of our mind. It's not that we're caught up in thinking. Thinking is too grand a term. Thinking is what philosophers do. We're usually just caught up in habitualized cognition, in rumination, in planning, in worrying, in thought, really, in a sort of storm of thought. And usually we're so caught up in that, so wrapped up in that, we don't notice the world around us, we don't notice very deeply other people, we don't even notice very deeply ourselves, even including our own emotions sometimes. We're just stuck in this world of talking. So the Buddha would say, well, the first thing we need to do is notice that and step into awareness. So step into immediate experience of where we are just now. So as I'm talking now, you can do it as I'm talking, and I can do it as I'm talking. So you can notice, for instance, where your hands and your feet are. You can notice people coming through the door. You can notice the weight of your body as you're sitting here on the chair or the cushion, can't you? You don't have to stop listening to me. You don't have to close your eyes and be all spiritual. You can just notice the sensation of your bottom on the cushions or the chair. You can notice if your back is leaning against the wall, if what your hands are touching. And as I talk, I can notice the clothes on my legs, my socks. I can notice whether my shoulders are tense and so on. And I can do that and I can carry on talking. But as soon as I do that, as soon as I start to notice my body, I start to breathe a bit better. I start to come into a slightly deeper awareness of myself and a slightly deeper experience of you. And you'll find the same, I suggest. That as you notice your body, you start to appear in the world. You start to be a person that's embodied. So this is the first thing that we need to learn to do. And it's a training that we can deepen and deepen. Especially we deepen it in meditation. But we can deepen it more and more in everyday life. So one of the things that this does that's really worth drawing out a little bit before I move on is that it steps us out of automatic pilot. So what our mind does, as I said, it's not so much that we think. Thinking is far too grand a term. What our mind does is runs on automatic. It has a kind of automatic pilot. Come in. Come on. Squeeze in. So our mind runs on automatic pilot. We just are somewhere else, aren't we? Our mind is just running along, doing all the things it does without us noticing. So this automatic pilot mode that we have is essential to human life. You couldn't drive a car without it. You couldn't go to the bank without it. You couldn't do many of the things that we take for granted without it. And that's because we take those things for granted. So for instance, when you learn to drive, you experience the experience of having to think about everything you did, didn't you? Where you, someone has to say, in mirror, signal, manoeuvre, and it was all terribly clumsy and really rather hard to do, this sense of trying to draw into the centre of your mind activities, which you then did. And then you had to think, okay, now I need to do that. And you do it very mentally, don't you? It's really rather tiring. It's a bit like when you first learned to play the piano. It's very, very tiring trying to think of what you're doing, all the things you're trying to do. But gradually, as you learn to drive, eventually you can drive all the way to work without thinking about it at all. You don't think about looking into the mirror, you don't think about anything. You can be thinking about the meeting that you're going to. You can miss the whole journey, can't you, effectively, whilst your mind does all the things that you need to drive. It can be quite shocking, can't it? You get somewhere and you realise that you've no idea how you got there, that somehow your body has managed to get your car through traffic to work without you taking part at all. You were just somewhere else. Yeah? So that's your automatic mind at work. It's the oldest part of your brain. It's the part of your brain that makes it possible to do many of the things, walk through a forest, eat meals, that you don't need your new brain to think about. It's interesting that they've got computers, haven't they? A computer, quite a small computer, can beat you at chess, but even the most elaborate computer still can't walk through a wood, because it just can't. That's just far, far too difficult. We can walk through a wood, and in that way we're much better at computers. So that automatic mind is very important to us, but it has real dangers. One of the things I've been feeling more and more as I've practiced Buddhism, I've been practicing Buddhism and meditation for 20 years now, is how dangerous the mind is. The mind is both capable of incredible wonders and depths beyond our usual assumptions. One of the, again, the tragedy of the West, I think, is that we don't realise how much we're missing out on, especially because we don't have a tradition of meditation in the West. We don't realise how much more there is to our mind, how much depth there is to it, how much richness there is to our experience, if only we were to turn our attention to that. We sort of have forgotten that in the West. Yes, but irrespective of that, the mind is also very dangerous. So one of the dangers of the mind is this automatic pilot. So what will happen, if you're not careful, your mind just starts to do the things it automatically does. And it does the things it automatically does out of habit. So our mind is like, it's a bit like rain falling in India, and it falls on the mud plains or whatever, and it doesn't just fall and soak into the ground, it cuts grooves, doesn't it, in the ground. And what happens is that as the rain in the monsoon pours down, it cuts these grooves in the ground, and the more it cuts those grooves, more of the water of the rain rushes down those grooves, the more water rushes into it, the deeper the groove gets, the more water rushes into it. Yeah? So that is a picture of our mind. Everything we do, everything we say, everything we feel cuts kind of grooves in our mind, and the more those grooves get cut, the more the mind runs down that particular groove. What they're starting to say in science is that what wires together, fires together. That your brain creates literally new sort of nerve pathways, are down habitualized ways of using it. You know? They've done an interesting study about why elderly people fall over a lot. Yeah? They do so in the West, but not so much at all in the East. And they think it's to do with shoes. So what we've got, these incredible nerve patterning in our feet, incredibly sophisticated nerve pattern, that help us really detect uneven ground, so that our feet are highly attuned to differences in texture and so on. But as you wear shoes all your life, you don't need much of that nervous system. Yeah? So the nerve endings in your feet no longer work. They all kind of fuse together. So they read your experience much less accurately. So by the time you're elderly, you're much more likely to fall over. So you don't need those careful calibrations of surface anymore, or you think you don't. So you just, your nerves just stop giving you that reading. So our mind is like that. Yeah? What wires together, fires together, the grooves that we created in our mind is the way our mind will go. So if we habitually get irritated, if we habitually blame people, if we habitually get into low states of mind, if we habitually get anxious, if we habitually just want pleasant experience one after another, our mind will act like that automatically more and more. And the more it acts like that automatically more and more, the more it will do that in the future. In Buddhism it says that mind creates world. That how you've been just now creates who you are now. How you've been in the past creates who you are now and creates who you are in the future. So that automatic pilot mode, I meant to say this much about this, means that when we're not attending, when you're decorating your flat or when you're eating a meal or when you're walking to the bank, your mind very easily just drifts back to its normal setting, its habitualized automatic mode. So if that's going into mental arguments in your head, it'll just start to do that. If that's to do with starting to have feelings of inadequacy, it will start to do that. It just drifts back into its automatic setting that you've actually created by doing that kind of thing again and again. So I had an example of that just recently where I was cycling something in the evening and was going through an argument in my head. I don't know whether you've done it, I'm sure you have. Don't pretend you haven't. It won't help. I think it's a very interesting kind of thing, this whole experience we all have of having an argument in our head. And that is that our body, for instance, doesn't make any differentiation between the actual argument and the argument we're having in our head. So your body does all the things as if it's actually happening. So when we do that, we may as well just be having the argument. So we are actually having the same argument again and again and again and again, and that argument may never actually happen with that person. But they are for us. So they make us unhappy, they make us, when we're doing that in our mind, they make us tense, adrenaline goes into the system to fight or flight, your blood pressure goes up, your eyes dilate to help you see, etc., etc. All the blood moves from the primary organs into the skeletal muscles so you can run. Yeah? All that happens whether you're having a shower, cycling a bike, or on the holiday of a lifetime, without the person that you're arguing with ever being present. And if you're English, they may never know that you have anything to argue with. In fact, you're more and more likely to get more and more polite to the person that you're arguing with if you're English like me. You'll be scrupulously polite whilst raging against somebody in the privacy of your mind. Yeah? It's the English way of hatred. So it's interesting that when we do that example, actually we're causing ourselves suffering again and again and again. We can have arguments that really make us feel very unhappy that never actually happen in reality. Not only that, but when you think about it, it's even more odd than that. We start thinking, then, oh, they'll say this. Oh, well, I'll say this. And that'll get... And then you say this kind of thing that's going to do them for one. And then they answer back. They say, well, you would say that because... And then you get even more angry at what they said back to you. But they're not there. What they said back to you is what you said back to you in your mind, which you've now got even more angry about. You see what I mean? It is really quite peculiar. If we met someone from Venus or from another star system, we'd have to really talk them through this. They'd say, okay, hang on, tell me again. You're having a shower, it's all quite pleasant, and then you start having an argument about something that hasn't happened, yeah? And then they say things in your mind which haven't happened, and you get even more angry about them. Yes. You know what I mean? It would be very difficult to kind of explain it all, wouldn't it? They really, really would think that you're kind of mad. And the Buddha said that all prasajanas, which means all people who follow a worldly life, all people who don't try and cultivate awareness, are mad. And they're mad because they do that kind of thing, yeah? So I was having one of my arguments in my mind the other day, cycling along, and I suddenly spoke out loud saying, that's very interesting, Matra Bandhu. really marvellous, 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 really good points, excellent points. Let's kind of stop now. Yeah? Let's think about something else. Yeah. And I could it was very, and I literally said it out loud, and people again would think I'm mad. I was saying to myself, okay, that's a wonderful point, that's a wonderful point, marvellously made, gorgeous diction. Now can we go on to actually enjoying my cycle around, enjoying the evening, feeling other things, thinking about other things. And whilst I worked like that in my mind, I could feel myself getting into a better state again. As soon as I stopped and just, you know, the automatic pilot moved back in, I just felt my mind drift back to the argument again. Yeah? It's like it's got this kind of pull, this magnetic pull, back to the habitual and automatic. So the Buddha would say that the first thing we need to do is step out of automatic pilot. We need to train into doing that by stepping into direct experience of the body and its movements. Yeah? Direct awareness of the body and its movements. So that's coming away from this persistent mind storms into what is actually going on in the body here and now. And we try to train ourselves in that. Yeah? It's not easy to do, it's quite challenging to try to do, especially when there are difficulties, because the instinct is to get more and more caught up into rumination, into aberrant problem solving, as it's called. And we just kind of want to get stuck in that. Yeah? So that was the first sphere, that's the first sphere of mindfulness, which I talk about in the book. Let me just say one or two things, and then I'll open it out to questions. So, first of all, we need to come back to our body, okay? Then we need to move on to the second sphere of mindfulness, which is to notice how it feels to have that argument. Now, what I mean by that is, how does it feel in the body to be going through this in our mind? Yeah? What is actually going on? Yeah? So whether it's that we're really wanting just now to go off shopping after this, and when's this guy going to stop talking about religion? I'm rather looking forward to coffee. You start to notice, what does that feel like in your body to want something that you're not presently having? What does that actually do to your experience? Just as what does it feel like in your body to not want something that you're having? What does it feel like in your body to get angry, to get sorry for yourself, to get anxious about something, to become elated even? Yeah? And you try to drop beneath the narrative, and most of what we call ourself is really just a narrative, a repeating narrative, a habitualized, automatic narrative that we take very, very seriously indeed, that we believe to be a description of ourselves and reality, but which is really an interpretation of ourselves and reality, and often a distortion of ourselves and reality. So what we're trying to do is notice the thoughts we get stuck in. What so-and-so does, the person who doesn't ever wash up, why we're always having to do all the work at work, or whatever it is, a habitualized narrative, drop beneath that into the Vedana, it's called, the sensations, the feeling tone of what that's like in the body. Yeah? And you try to bear that, you try to notice that, you try to turn towards that and actually feel it, rather than get stuck in the on the windscreen of our mind, on the sort of front of our mind. You try to feel what this is actually doing in our experience just now. So next time when you're having an argument in your mind, you just see, hang on, say, okay, I've got all this thought, how does that make me feel in my body? So when we're doing that, we're cultivating mindfulness of two things, really. We're cultivating mindfulness of Vedana. Vedana is a Buddhist word, it means sensation, feeling, you could say. It doesn't mean emotions, it means just whether something feels pleasant or unpleasant or somewhere in between. So when you are in an argument in your mind, you'll notice in your body you feel unpleasant, it feels unpleasant. And you try to become aware of that feeling unpleasant, try to be with that feeling of unpleasant without acting out of that feeling unpleasant. This is actually the gap of freedom. This is the place where your life can change. You're standing on the tube, it's hot and muggy, it's crowded, you get to your tube stop and you get a funny anxious feeling that you won't be able to get to the door, even though you always have been able to get to the door,
but you have that funny feeling, don't you? Oh no, I'm in the middle, and I now won't be able to get to the door. If you look carefully, you think, right then. And I mean, a while ago, I saw this incident with somebody trying to get off, somebody trying to get on. And eventually, it was a woman trying to get off, a woman trying to get on, and the woman trying to get off eventually hit this woman trying to get on. Actually, all that was happening is that both people were having unpleasant Vedana. Do you see what I mean? One was on the bus, on the tube, feeling hot, tired, day after a long day's work. Then they had this horrible, uneasy feeling that they might not be able to get off because it's so crowded. They then start to act on that uneasy feeling by using their elbows. The woman getting on is hot, is tired, she's had a long day at work, she's been on the computer all day, she just wants to get home, and oh my God, the door's open, and it doesn't look like she's going to be able to get on. That gives her an uneasy feeling, more unpleasant Vedana. She pushes on, hits the woman pushing on, and they hit her. So what you get is more unpleasant Vedana still. Yeah, more unpleasant feeling still. So what our chance of is to step out of automatic pilot into body awareness, deepen that into noticing how the body feels, and then not react to that. Try to be with that without reacting to that. Because if you react to that, all you do is make it worse, usually. You make it worse for yourself, and you make it worse for other people. You end up hitting somebody getting on. So you could think of that, therefore, as these first three stages of mindfulness. Noticing your body, noticing how your body feels, noticing what your mind does in response to that. It wants to push, it starts to get angry. You start to come up with theories, don't you, about London Transport and how you would run it if you were Prime Minister. And when is the Prime Minister going to turn his attention to London? You know, you can get into a whole tirade about the world and overcrowding. All that's really happening, folks, is you're feeling uncomfortable. Yeah. But we turn that into a whole mental philosophy which allows us to then use our elbows, as it were, which makes the pain worse. So on the basis of those three things, on the basis of noticing your body, on the basis of noticing how you feel in the experience, on the basis of noticing what your mind does with those feelings, it doesn't have to do it with those feelings, you just have a deep impulse to respond to painful feeling with negative thoughts, just as you respond to pleasant feelings by thoughts that want more of that. Interestingly, it works in reverse, doesn't it? As soon as you want more of something, you experience less and less pleasure. It's the law of diminishing returns. There's been more and more study into this, talking about the hedonic treadmill. That as soon as you want pleasure, you immediately start to vitiate the pleasure you're experiencing. The more you get into that, the less pleasure you have. Yeah? So our strategies around our experience often don't work. Our trying to push experience away because it's unpleasant makes the unpleasant experience worse. And our trying to have more pleasurable experience vitiates the pleasure that we actually have. Yeah. It's called the hedonic treadmill, or that's one psychologist has been talking about it. It means diminish. Yeah. So you just get the law of diminishing returns. So apparently, if you do studies, you find that the first square of chocolate that you eat is the most pleasurable. Yeah. It's massive. You get all your nerves go, to everything gets turned on. The second square of chocolate, nobody's turning anything on because you know that now. So the second square of chocolate is half as pleasurable as the first one. By the time you get to the third, it's just calories. You don't notice it at all. Yeah? So you get this law of diminishing returns. And the way to keep on upping the pleasure is to increase the stimulus. This is why drugs can go like that. You just have to take more and more and more to get the same hit that you first had. The first kiss is difficult to replicate later on, yeah? Because you have... Anyway, never mind, let's not get into it. Let's keep it clean, folks. So on the basis of trying to gain an insight into unpleasant experience, and if we push it away, we make it worse. Pleasant experience, if we try to have more of it, we undermine it, we have less of it, we end up actually with pain. If you try and squeeze pleasure out of your weekend this weekend, here's one of those wonderful things, a weekend, le weekend, as the French now call it. we have this wonderful thing we've all been looking forward to, the weekend, and this weekend means pleasure, doesn't it? It means, it's okay, it starts, the weekend starts here, it ends there, and that's pleasure, blah, 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 blah. But if you try and do that, if you try and stack this weekend with pleasure, squeeze more and more pleasure into it, squeeze more and more pleasure out of it, what you'll end up with is pain. What you'll end up with is pain. Try it, if you don't believe me. Just try and get as much pleasure over this weekend as you possibly can. See how you feel on Sunday evening. Okay? And come back and talk to me about it. So on the basis of that, and the basis of training in that, you move on to the fourth sphere of mindfulness, which is you try to think how best it is to act. This is called the mindfulness of dharmas. You try to make wise choices about your behaviour. You try to think what's in your actual best interests. In the moment, you try to, in other words, from a Buddhist point of view, you tread the path of Buddhism. You try to, more and more in every moment, try to experience your direct experience and decide how best to act in your own best interests, and in the interests of those around you. Now, before I finish, that's the path talked about from one particular perspective, or one sort of adumbration of the path talked about in one way. Coming back to our first point about wanting to be happy, that issue that we have is not a psychological one at base. It is, for many of us, to a large degree, psychological. But even when you're sort of psychologically fine and happy, you still haven't solved that issue. Because you want to be not just happy, you want to be deeply happy, supremely happy, and you want to be that all of the time. So yeah, that was nice enough, but not quite enough. Have you ever had that experience where you think, yeah, well, it was all right, it was all very nice, and yet you think, something's kind of missing. You have that late night toast crisis, which particularly happens on a Sunday evening, doesn't it, where you've had this pleasure weekend, but you can't quite go to bed on Sunday night. And it's been nice, it's been good, you've seen a film, you went to a cafe with a friend, you read the newspapers. But you're left with this sort of, is that it, kind of feeling. So you think, tell you what, a piece of toast. That is the final thing. You're still wanting something. Because it's not just that we want pleasure, is it? We also want deep experience. We also want meaning. So you can often feel this sense of that something's still missing. So from a Buddhist point of view, what's missing is enlightenment. What's missing is a complete insight into your own mind and a letting go of that tendency to push away discomfort and to pull toward us pleasures. Because it's in that push and pull that we're constantly involved in that actually creates our unhappiness at the deepest level. If we could just stop wanting something and not wanting something, the whole of life would appear to us. If you imagine just walking out and sitting in the park just after this talk, and you could really stop wanting anything to happen and really stop not wanting anything to happen. You can imagine it, couldn't you? Sit on the park bench. You don't want to move, but you don't want to not move. You don't think, I tell you what, if I just have a coffee, a cigarette and a book, this will be perfect. Or I tell you what, if only that strimmer would stop, then I'd be happy. Do you see what I mean? That's what we do, isn't it? Yes, happiness is here, but unfortunately it's marred by this thing that needs to be pushed away and this thing that needs to be pulled towards us. If you could just be there without wanting anything or not wanting anything, what actually would happen? What is our experience now, as it were? Say it was now, what would our experience actually be? If I was talking and I didn't want to stop or didn't want to not stop, you were listening and you didn't want me to stop and you didn't want me to not stop, what would happen, for instance, to time? What is time exactly? Isn't time just a kind of wanting? If you didn't want anything, would time exist anymore? I mean, we've got clock time, haven't we, and watch time. But we don't experience time like that. What is time? Quite. If we didn't want anything, what would be happening? Is it really? Something, it feels to me, would arise. Something completely new would arise. A new kind of being.
a new kind of being within our own being. And that's what the Buddha represents. He represents a new kind of species that arises from within our own self. Yeah? A wholly new experience arising from the usual self. If you imagine sitting in the park, not wanting anything, not wanting anything, if you could really do that, the Buddha would arise in your own experience. And that would be a wholly new way of perceiving. And that is, from a Buddhist point of view, the final solution to our human predicament. It's not a sort of thing about, well, this is to do with, this is what people should do. It's that the human predicament is already a predicament. It's a kind of problem. It's a kind of problem with a capital P. It's a kind of koan. We want to be happy all the time. We don't know where happiness is to be found. Anyone who thinks deeply needs to think about that fundamental question. Okay, so that's what I wanted to start to talk about, the four spheres of mindfulness, how that relates to happiness and our search for happiness, and how that relates to the Buddhist vision of the goal of Buddhism, which is not to become a large statue covered with gold leaf, but to experience this wholly new new being that arises from who it is that we've been up to now. So we've got a bit of time, so there's a chance to ask questions, and then I'll say a few things before we finish, and then we'll finish just before two.
You talked about point number four being arriving at a position where you make choices.
Wise choices, yeah.
And what stops us from making those choices that are favourable to us? And you were saying before
yes.
that there's pushing and pulling, and you want to pull in the experiences that make you feel better. When you
yeah.
arrive at those choices, and you are in a situation where you are faced with those choices, how do you determine which choice to make that might or should be the choice that you feel the pain, that you don't avoid those ones?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense. Yeah, yeah. Let me try and answer it in a few ways, and that might... But one of the things that strikes me immediately is that we very often sacrifice long-term goals for short-term pleasures, don't we? And we do it instinctively. We tend to go for what we immediately want, not what's in our longer-term interest. And we find it quite difficult sometimes to go for things that are in our longer-term interest. So, for instance, there's a question of sugar. So, we're designed to like sugar. Most of our prehistory, sugar was very scarce. If we like it, we're likely to want to have more of it. And if we had more of it, for most of human history, we are more likely to survive. So our liking for sugar is actually encoded into our being. You know, it's to do with our evolution. It's how this organism has developed so that we can survive. We find it pleasurable, so we want more of it. It's worked marvellously up till probably the last 50 years, 100 years. But now, for the first time, sugar, at least in the West, is over-plentiful. But you've got no restraining factor naturally in your experience. So our desire to repeat pleasure is probably evolutionary, if you see what I mean. It's to do with getting things, doing things repeatedly, so that we'll do them, so we'll survive. And sex is part of that, isn't it? If you want to do it again... to have the survival of the species. Let's not go too far in that direction, but it's probably evolutionary. But there's no restraining impulse in your biology. Your biology just will do its automatic thing. You have sugar, you like it, you want more. Suddenly we're in a new condition where sugar is over-plentiful and it's now becoming a threat to our health. But we've got no restraining faculty in our experience. We have to actually create that restraining faculty. One of the things that I've been concerned about in modern life, as it were, is that how are we going to get that now? Everything is more and more to do with our own individual choice. Everything is focused on, do you want this or not? And you'll tend to just go with what you want, irrespective of whether it's your long-term interest, whether it's online pornography, whether it's sugar, whether it's whatever. You tend to just click on. You just add to basket. And then it says...
customers who bought sugar also like lollipops and cake. And you can click on to add to all those to the basket as well, yeah? So there doesn't seem to be a natural restraining impulse. So what Buddhism is saying is that you need to create a gap. And this is where this place between feeling the body and how the body feels and acting is so important. You need to create a gap between what you want or don't want and how you actually behave. It's very, very difficult to do. One needs to train in it. And that's what training in awareness is. It's a training to create a gap. So you notice, okay, I'm feeling... Say you're at home and you're with a family, and you notice, I'm starting to feel a bit grumpy here. So instead of not noticing that and just acting out of that and making the whole situation worse, you create the gap between your experience and your actions. And we need to train in that, creating the gap. We won't do it naturally. It can become more natural to us if we keep doing it, and that's what training in mindfulness is. It's something that we need to train in over years and years to keep on bringing ourselves back to a gap of experience. But it won't happen naturally. We won't naturally make the choices. Well, very easily won't, anyway. If we're in a better state, we tend to more, don't we? If we're in a good state of mind, we can say no to the second slice of the cake. We can think, actually, no, it's just not worth getting into an argument about this. We have experiences, don't we, all of us, of managing our life better. But very easily that experience breaks up and we start reacting to our experience again. So it's vitally important for us to learn, I think, this skill of mindfulness, to notice our experience and create that gap. One of the main ways we do that is by learning meditation, but it's much, much more than that. But yes, I don't think it will come naturally.
So what you're saying as well is that you shouldn't avoid the unpleasant.
No. Well, you can avoid trying.
You try to do that, don't you?
Yes, you do, instinctively.
You become aware of it, you don't want to experience it.
Yeah.
You try to avoid them, but
that's
they just
right.
keep coming back again.
That's right, indeed.
So how do you then embrace them to make them something that you benefit from and learn from?
Yes, indeed. Well, first of all, it's counterintuitive. So when you have an unpleasant experience, the thing you immediately want to do is get rid of it. In fact, the way you know something is an unpleasant experience is you immediately want it to stop. The way you know something is a pleasurable experience is you immediately want to repeat it. Yeah? That's just, we're hardwired to do that. Pleasurable experience, more please. Unpleasant experience, no, absolutely not, not now, not ever. That's what we're wired to. Yeah? So actually turning towards that is counterintuitive. It goes against what you expect will help. Yeah? But if we don't turn towards it, we'll just react out of it, and that will make matters worse. And it started to try to actually learn that in our experience, which is not an easy thing to learn. But once you start to learn it, you start to find that your life can become more fruitful, that you do start to make better choices, that you're in better relationship with people around you, you're in better relationship with yourself, you can work with difficulty more. You start to feel more motivated to turn your mind to it. Also, it can become curiously precious. Particularly in meditation, if you turn to difficult experience, something slightly miraculous can happen. A whole new kind of experience can arise just by not habitually doing what you always do. But our instinct with unpleasant experience is to push it away, and that instinct doesn't work. We can try it. I mean, just try it out, but it won't work. It'll make your relationships worse with people. It'll make the society... I mean, one of the things I notice going around in the tubes now is just how much anger there is. How quickly people are to take offence. How quickly people give offence. I was standing waiting for a bus and I had a little girl with me, a little three-year-old girl. And I was talking to her. Somebody came past with a pram and somebody else was there. And this woman with the pram says, "Do you mind moving?" You know, she's immediately offended. And this other woman said, "Oh, yes." You know, it's just a terrible sort of moment. And there seems to be more and more of that. And that's what we'll create, if we're not careful, is a world of exasperation, a world of constantly giving and taking offence. A terrible kind of world, really. That's what our so-called freedoms will end us with. And also, it's striking, isn't it, with technology. I think we've just got more and more used to getting everything in a click. If you get it when you press click, add to basket, and it doesn't work, you get really irritated if something takes more than a click now. You just think, you just click on the website, it just flips up. If it takes even like a second long, you're like, what's going on? In the old days, you click and go, you go out and make a coffee, come back and you go, coming down the screen. It didn't make you angry, but now your expectations for what can happen have gone up massively, which is partly creating much more irritation, because your expectations are much higher. You transfer that to public transport, onto all kinds of other things. So we really vitally need to learn these lessons, and I don't think society is going to help us very much anymore, because society wants us to buy things, primarily. And that's to do with getting us to want something and getting us not to reflect on that, but getting us to just take out our credit card. Really, that's increasing what Western society, at least secularised Western society, wants us to do. Of course, there's a reaction to that in religious fundamentalism, saying, no, what we should do is the opposite, and that just, and this new sort of religious fundamentalism arising as a reaction to that problem. Long answer to your question. Possibly doesn't fully answer it either. One, two, three more, okay?
Can I just ask, you're talking about this gap.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, something you said earlier about in that gap, being able to act in the interest of yourself, but also others around you.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm just interested in who you're acting for in that gap.
Yes, oh, yes, very
especially
good question.
Being in East London.
Yeah. In a certain sense, it doesn't matter. All you need to learn is that that gap is a gap of creativity, really. A gap in which a new creative response can arise. That instead of shouting at this moment, or instead of collapsing to self-pity, or instead of elbowing my way off a tube, a new response could arise out of that gap. A new self can arise, not the automatic, habitual self that does it this way. You know, we habitually react to difficult experience along habitual lines, don't we? So some people distract themselves, some people catastrophize, some people fall into self-pity, and some people blame, basically. They're all our habitualized reactions to difficult experience, and they're all counterproductive. So the gap would create the possibility for a new response to difficult experience. But another way of saying it is that you could start by saying, okay, if I want to be happy, this argument in my mind is not in my own best interest. It's actually currently making me unhappy. So I need to change that. That needs to mean that I need to change my relationship to my narrative, but I probably need to change my relationship to the person. And that only by doing that will I be happy. So you can just do it for yourself. Or you can say, which I think is more Buddhist, is not how can I be happy, but how can we be happy? In a way, that's the main shift we need to, particularly in the West, create, is how can we be happy? So when you're with your partner, it's not how can I be happy in this situation, how can we be happy in this situation? Because if you get your own way and they don't, they won't be happy, and soon enough you won't be. So how can we be happy? Here we are in this room, how can we be happy? How can we be happy in my family? How can we be happy at work? And I think that can get bigger and bigger. How can we be happy as human beings on the planet? One of the things we could do is give some of our money to people on the other side of the planet, because our money does us very little good. Studies show that once you can afford a cup of coffee, and once you can afford to buy my book, clever ploy, make mental note, PR people. Once you can afford to buy a book and a coffee, any more money you get after then makes a negligible effect to your happiness. Yeah. If you give money to people who are below the poverty line, it makes a massive change to their happiness level. Yeah? The richest people in America, the top 200 richest people in America, who are unimaginably wealthy, are only marginally happier than the average American. So when we think, how can we be happy, one of the things we need to do as a species is redistribute our wealth. Because yeah? It's not doing us as much good as it's cracked up to do. There was another two questions.
Awesome.
You were one, weren't you? Yeah.
I think it's probably more of an observation than a question.
Right, yeah.
It's a very refreshing talk, thank you very much. And a lot in it, but I'm right at the beginning, you said what we're chasing after happiness.
Yeah.
And I think a penny's dropped. Everything I've done has been to find happiness.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Now, the thing about this is that everything I've done is to find happiness. So if I go to the gym,
yeah,
I walk out of the gym and I think, well, I'm not wildly happy,
yeah,
but I've done something good.
It's better than walking out of the pub.
Well, that's the second point.
Yeah, yeah. Depending how much you've drunk.
If I smoke and drink,
yeah,
I'm seeking happiness.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I've done something bad,
yeah.
Especially the next day I wake up with a hangover.
Let me just say something about that, because I think that's very interesting, because that's an extension of that point, isn't it? Even the negative things, the negative things we do to become happy.
Mm.
Yeah? Even the terrible things we do to become happy. So our basic instinct is to become happy. So I remember taking up smoking. I took up smoking, after I was a Buddhist, I'm afraid, shame. You know, I took it, basically I was having a difficult experience, and then what would start to happen, I'm giving a wave, what would start to happen is that I'd start pouncing a cigarette off somebody, and then they'd eventually say, why don't you buy your own? And then that one famous day came when I did buy my own, and then I started to smoke and felt a bit unhappy, and then before I knew it, as soon as I felt any kind of unease, I'd want to go and have a cigarette. It happens really, really quickly. I was doing that to be happy. I was doing that because it gave me a break, because it made me feel like I was doing something for myself. You know, I'm being a rebel, you know, talking about the state of the world, whatever. But actually, subterraneously, you know that it's not in your own best interest. So do you see what I mean? We need to notice that everything we do, even terrible things like the desire to commit suicide, for instance, is because you really think it will make you happier. Or at least it will stop it being so painful, so you will be left with happiness, effectively. So everything we do is to be happy. So we need to think, well, so how, this is where wise choices really come in. Out of awareness, what's really going to help? Going to the gym is going to be much better than getting tanked out in the pub or whatever it is. Yeah. And we need to refine that more and more. Where does our happiness really lie? But everything we do, even the most destructive thing we do, is because we really believe it will make us happy and it will make our group happy. So we want to go and bomb one person because it will make me feel more secure. If I'm more secure, I'll feel more happy. If only other people didn't act like that, and they did what I tell them to do, then I'd feel happy and secure, because everybody would be doing and believing and thinking what I think and believe. Yeah? So even those massive world things are to do with us all wanting to be happy. So in a way, the thing to leave us with is to think about that, and think how can we cultivate mindfulness, so that we start to make better and better choices in our own interests, but in the interests of all beings. Okay. So we better finish there, otherwise I'm going to go into the next person's slot and make them unhappy. Thank you very much.